There was a lot of dilemma, and I wasn't being able to definitely deal with the sudden knowledge of my cancer and to be able to impart that information in a much more containing and structured manner so that my patients can be held even in that situation. But the consciousness was there and how to go about it. Whenever I was asked by the patient directly, or if the necessity arose where the hospital needed to impart the information, I did agree later that they can let them know about the cancer situation and the patient can connect directly. When I was in a better stage and I knew how to deal with it. But that was months later. And I found that the honest submission was more helpful for me and for the patient, because when certain larger things, larger than life, certain events happen which is larger than life, it probably connects us in a much more humble way to the community, that the analyst, the healer, is not supreme above all of this, and who can also be affected with such aspects of life.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Juma Basak. Dr. Basak is a training and supervising psychoanalyst of the Indian Psychoanalytic Society. And our conversation today is about her journey with cancer. This is not an unusual occurrence for an analyst to have experience with cancer, but it is unusual in the way she shares it and is open about it, both her personal dealings with it and how it affected and lived in her clinical work. We start off by her giving the details of her medical burdens and challenges, how she struggled with how to inform patients about it, and how she also had to work with an intermediary of her hospital. And she very openly and honestly describes her fragility and uncertainty about how to go about this. She shares with us a notion that is very familiar to her, but wasn't to me, and I suspect not to many of our listeners, what she calls honest submission in terms of how she told patients about her condition. And I will leave it to her to describe what that means. She also shares how she dealt with her patient's curiosity and the issues of patient's aggression and tenderness towards her. We consider the issue of the afterlife. This is in India, and she describes how common the Hindu notion of an afterlife is. And she also shares with us her sense that, quote, the clinical becomes vast. And what she means by that is that the learning that she has gotten from this challenge in her life, her clinical challenge and personal challenge, is something that she thinks is important to take beyond the consulting room. Indeed, she calls it off the couch. We close with some disguised clinical vignettes, one of which really quite beautifully demonstrates how, even if not especially, real life trauma in current day can still be used meaningfully to awaken for the patient a new awareness and a new memory of forgotten pains in their past. Juma is, she holds a PhD in psychology. She has a special interest in culture and gender in psychoanalysis, and she has published in Japanese, Italian, French, and Spanish. She has presented at various IPA congresses, and she was a keynote speaker at the 2023 IPA Congress in Cartagena. She is the co-editor of a book, Psychoanalytic and Socio-Cultural Perspectives on Women in India, and editor of Sculpting Psychoanalysis in India, Sudhir Kakkar. She has been the past co-chair of the Asia Committee on Women and Psychoanalysis and continues to be its consultant. I found our conversation to be really important and touching, and something that not everybody could do, and I share my appreciation for her stepping forward in this way. And I hope, I certainly learned from it, and I hope everybody shares the importance of this. Here's my conversation with Dr. Juma Basak. Juma, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. Our psychoanalytic space is imbued with childhood magic, which includes the sense that, like the unconscious, that we somehow exist outside of time. Illness and debility and mortality become known in this space, essentially through their metaphoric gravitas. And in fact, they do carry these echoes and ghosts from the past for both analyst and analysand. But not only. The acknowledgement of the actual passage of time exposes us to a very unmetaphoric vulnerability. Our clinician population of analysts tend to be older, and our treatments are lengthy. And as a result, illness is not unusual, if not common. And yet we don't speak of it at all with the frequency with which it occurs. And I want to begin our conversation today with an acknowledgement of my both appreciation and respect for your willingness and ability to share with us the story of your medical travails, as well as how it has lived with you in your clinical work. So let me turn to you now and invite you to tell us about your illness. And from there, we'll go to your work.
Thank you, Harvey. So let me begin with this is 2024, so early 2023, in the beginning of January, I was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And before that, it is important that I mention that a year and a half, I carried the symptoms of the disease. And unfortunately, it went misdiagnosed for a year and a half. And when I got the news of my bladder cancer in January 2023, I was naturally very much taken aback. because it was at a critical time. And another lapse of maybe 10 days or so could have been quite fatal. But fortunately, I did land up with a very, very good doctor at that point. And once the diagnosis was made, I had to go through immediate medical intervention, critical surgical intervention. So I went through a cystectomy, and after that, there followed a period of chemotherapy of 4 rounds, which comprises about 8 chemos. And then after that was the surgical, which was a major surgical procedure of radical cystectomy with ileal conduit, which allows me now to have carry a urostomy bag. And that's where I am now. It's been a year, actually, precisely a year this month, that I complete my surgery, post-surgical progression. And I'm doing fairly well. As a matter of fact, I've been able to get back to my work to quite some extent, my regular activities, and I'm making good progress, as my doctor says.
Mm-hmm. So glad to hear. You have thought a great deal about how this has impacted you and your clinical work. Can you walk us through the experience, starting with the practical aspects? When you found out, how you told people, what you told people, people as in patients, what their reactions were, how you managed their reactions. And from there, we can talk more about how you understood the transformation that was happening in you, about you, and about the work. But start us off with the practice.
So naturally, because it was so sudden, there was no plan as such, organized plan. There wasn't time enough to inform personally. I was myself undergoing not only the difficulty of absorbing the diagnosis, but also in a very practical sense, to go through the procedure of the treatment of the medical intervention. So my mm-hmm. partner, she came into helping me how to go about informing patients, the hospital. As much as possible, my concern was, as much as I could make it possible, to impart with the information of not being able to continue with my therapeutic engagement with my patients personally to them, through messages, wherever there was phone calls, to be able to attend and talk. I tried to make it, to keep it sensitively delivered, and how not to make it impersonal. So these were my two concerns, actually, which was a difficulty where the hospital and clinic came into the picture.
Just to be clear, you work in two venues. You work in a hospital and privately?
Yes.
So you had two different groups of people to tell.
Yeah, I was working in two hospitals, so I had to inform the hospital first. And they, of course, asked if the patients would be all right to connect with me directly. In many situations, of course, I agreed, though I couldn't directly take the call because the procedure of the treatment already started and I was myself in the hospital going through all the tests necessary. But I tried to make it possible that I could be reached. If I wasn't directly reachable, then my family would respond. This was with the idea because I thought it was important that my patients, with whom I was sharing at that point of time, a dyadic engagement with them. And this happened during that period. And I felt that this was something that I owe an honest submission to them. The initial phase was not to disclose directly that I had cancer, but to say that my work was kind of taking a halt for a while because I had to be hospitalized for certain critical investigation. And over time, one would have more information as to when I'll be able to get back. And so it was delivered over time. With the hospital, the information was given directly so that there was no confusion. Not being able to tell them when I'll be able to get back to work there. In that capacity, it was much more, I would say, the hospitals or the clinic has been much more compassionate. Informing the institute or the society came in much later because I guess the society and the institute are not so much in my daily work engagement as much as it has been my patients directly and the hospital. Unfortunately, because we don't talk about these things, and I definitely did not have this knowledge myself at that point about how to impart such informations, such critical situations, to how much to explain to my patients. There was a lot of dilemma, and I wasn't being able to definitely deal with the sudden knowledge of my cancer and to be able to impart that information in a much more containing and structured manner so that my patients can be held even in that situation. But the consciousness was there and how to go about it. Whenever I was asked by the patient directly, or if the necessity arose where the hospital needed to impart the information, I did agree later that they can let them know about the cancer situation, and the patient can connect directly. When I was in a better stage and I knew how to deal with it. But that was months later. I found that the honest submission was more helpful for me and for the patient, because when certain larger things, larger than life, certain events happen which is larger than life, it probably connects us in a much more humble way to the community, that the analyst, the healer, is not supreme above all of this, and who can also be affected with such aspects of life. Yes, it brings about a complexity of the situation and how patients will be able to deal with it. And in some situations, possibility of them maybe consulting somebody else in an interim period also came about, especially in the hospital situation where in-depth analytic work is not possible, mostly not possible. It's much more analytically oriented therapeutic work. So I think it was important for me to be able to share this with my patients to a certain extent, because I thought I kind of owed to them this honest submission, and also that creates the ground of the fact that the analyst is not in any, Kafkaesque kind of situation where he or she is unreachable and beyond all calamities of life. But it was not a very easy path because it was an unknown path that I was traveling. And it was much later that I read about professional will and constructs of that kind, which I think is something that definitely we had no idea during our training period, but something that probably we need to talk more about and see how this can be part of our knowledge system in the training process as well. Because it's not just about the illness. The worldwide political situation is also so volatile that disruptions in therapeutic work may come about in many situations and for many circumstances.
This may be a cultural reference or phrase, but you've used the term honest submission multiple times in terms of telling the patient what you were struggling with. Can you tell us what you mean by honest submission? Because it's not a familiar phrase to many of us.
I think honest as in, of course, ethical. And ethical towards life, towards my engagement with life. Till that point, my engagement with my patients, something which is larger than life, an illness like cancer, which is beyond one's control, to be able to convey that. And it's a submission. I say a submission because it's like bowing down and makes me more humble, makes me much more like a fellow human being and not in a pedestal as a clinician who is in a static role of healing alone, but is in a position at this point to be seeking for healing.
Did you find it to be the case that while you were drawn to the painful humility and vulnerability of your circumstance, that was especially challenging for patients who needed you to remain, at least at this point in their care, as an idealized, invulnerable character in their mind, and that they struggled with the conflict between your reality, which you shared with them, and their transference needs at that moment for you to be otherwise? And how did you manage that between the two of you?
I agree with you that the need within the patient to see the analyst, the therapist, as a consistent element of support and benevolence and healing, that gets shaken up. Yes, it was a challenge for me and a conflict. And I may still wonder whether that kind of imparted more anxiety in my patients to disrupt that. But that was a reality. And I thought that it was more conducive that I share that reality, the truthful aspect of that reality, rather than just to be silent, to just evade that. It would seem like they don't matter to me. It would seem like, how we treat maybe children, that this is too serious a matter. This cannot be discussed with them. And it's also like the healer is over and above everything else and cannot be reachable. I think this is important that the healer is also part of the community. And it makes it probably much more human, even to the patient, to look at the analyst in that aspect. It does bring about the situation of post, maybe post-illness, working post-illness, that do I have that time to be able to deal with that disruption, that anxiety? I was hoping at that point that I would have that time. And I still thought that it's better that I hope for that time and I get that opportunity rather to evade and not share this reality with them, where I was already in a reality, I was already in a shared dyadic exchange with them. It would have been almost like, a kind of abandonment, negligence that can be just wiped off. My patience can be just wiped off.
And I think looking over the field for the past decades, there's been an important trajectory of understanding about that honesty, about the realities of analyst vulnerabilities, that in days gone by or decades gone by, anonymity included real-life calamities just to say nothing. And I think we've come along an important way from that. At the same time, it brings up the question, in terms of what you shared with patients, I imagine some patients were endlessly curious. When, if you shared that you had cancer, well, that could be the beginning of 30 other questions. And how did you manage, A, how you felt about considering those questions, B, about how you helped patients become aware that they had those questions, without necessarily committing yourself to answer each and every one of them? How did you negotiate that?
The interesting part, I feel, Harvey, is that when they had that opportunity to actually invade me with 30 other questions, interestingly, they did not actually exercise that wish or that right. Which could be incidental. It's not that I was confident that, you know, they wouldn't do it. But I think the element of that patients can also, they do not only function on irrationality. They are sensitive human beings as well. And if they had curiosity, if they had many questions, sometimes it came out in a few questions, and sometimes with a few of my cases I've seen who have come back post my treatment, and I've just started work very recently. Some of them are bringing it out now in the therapeutic work in the analytic space, but. If there was very invasive questions, I did try to say that maybe we can talk about it later. I do not have all the answers now. And I think not evading that was something that held the balance in a certain way. I think it's evading that would have probably created much more anxiety in them, curiosity, or a sense of rejection, and that would have continued. It's like in a way, I think it was all still a joint dealing that was happening, and I think that feeling of still being jointly looking at even a disruption probably helped to some extent.
Mm-hmm. An interest that I've had in looking over the literature on this, it's an area that I've been involved in years past, is that there had been a great emphasis on how to help patients with their aggressive fantasies and how difficult that was when the analyst was indeed painfully vulnerable. And that is, of course, a real issue. At the same time, I have been under the impression that sometimes this supposed conflicted aggression also covers even more conflicted tenderness and affection, which hasn't gotten the same acknowledgement in much of the literature. And I wonder what your experience has been.
Very nice point you brought about. To tell you honestly, I was often very touched with the caring messages that I received from some of my patients. We can talk about the aggression, some of it that I am seeing now that I've started work, and some of them are with me again. It is there when in the clinical space post the disruption, it's coming now, but not when the period of, when the work stopped and my period of illness, I did not actually receive any hostile messages or aggressive behavior. Mm-hmm. I think we need to grant our patients with human sensitivity and compassion much more than we probably think they are capable of.
Yes, that's my point. Yeah,
I think it's this entire experience, the cancer experience. I'm still going through it. I'm not over it. Along with the disruption of the work, with whatever has transpired with my patients, and which is happening now as well, continues, makes me feel of our clinical work, the need to see the clinical work in a much more vast sense than in a very, very confined pathological manner.
You quoted a phrase to me, which I'm going to ask you about. You said how this affected you in your clinical work is that you've learned how the clinical has become vast. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, as I just mentioned a while back, and I think my perspective is also clearing out that the clinical is not pathological for me. It is a much larger, wider commitment, engagement, focus, trained, ethical engagement for the cultivation of a healthy mind and body, which also needs to acknowledge, include other community practices like education, the arts, and how complementary it can be. And in this capacity, I find the clinical to be vast and not necessarily pathological. And in this sense also, I would say that I see how on the couch expands to off the couch.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
And of course, I must mention that I was reading your interview by Bernstein a few days back, and I mentioned it to you about the making of the podcast. And so wonderfully, you also talked about off the couch aspect. I link to that. I connect to that.
Yes, it's an important part of our contribution to our community, certainly. I want to ask you about how religion has played a part for you, for your patients, for those in your community, if it has, how that the notions of omens and deities and afterlife, is that in the analytic space for you or your patients?
It absolutely is. If not very overtly, definitely in a very, very subtle manner, it absolutely is. The aspect, we've all grown up in India, especially the majority Hindu religious belief. I happen to be a Hindu also. So we've grown up with the idea of afterlife. And it's not just necessarily Hindu religious belief of afterlife, life after death. It's also a very Eastern way of looking at life. In a sense, mortality has been in our awareness, in our growing up, where life after death is part of life in Earth, life right now. So that gives a sense of a discourse with mortality, even in lifetime. The articulation with mortality, the inclusion of mortality in lifetime. But it also, at the same time, creates a sense of eternity. So life is eternal, ever flowing. And that has an element of narcissistic bent, definitely. So life and death has a very interesting aspect culturally for us. Another way, we've also seen death, at least in a lot of, I would say, where I come from, Calcutta, where the Bengali culture grows up mostly with Tagore, the Bengali middle-class culture. It's a household name. Tagore has written explicitly on death, his poetry, his songs, which creates a sense of romanticism about death. And on the other side, we have crass reality of seeing animals dying on the road, people dying on the road. As a matter of fact, when I was very young, I recall when I was still in school at that time, and I used to go for my dance classes in those days. And there was this bus stop where there was a family living under the bus stop. And it was for years that I would be standing in that bus stop. And so I saw the family growing, actually, children coming into the family, people mm-hmm. getting older. And I remember on one occasion where a child, I would say a couple of years, maybe 2-3 years, was dead and the family was mourning on the road. So that kind of a very, I would say, drastic image of death also confronts us while growing up. With such huge population, and our lives are much more, the roads are very, very important in our lives, in the Indian life, where there's so much of chaos, noise, and roads are not just meant for traffic, buses and cars, vehicles. The roads are where lives happen in the Indian context. So, it's very interesting that it plays a very strong role in a very maybe subversive manner. Also, I think I was mentioning to you probably that we have an interesting contrast of funeral, I would say funeral pyres, or we call it ghats, and right next to it, we have the roadside tea joints. So one is almost can smell the burning of the body. And at the same time, you have people having tea. So there is a very contradictory reality that one grows up with. So it's a very rich an intense aspect of life and death, which works culturally. And I believe that works, that stays in me as much as in the patients and in the clinical space where we are working.
The role of afterlife, has that existed in your patients in the office with you? Has it been a source of comfort for them in imagining themselves or you? And has it been a source of comfort for you?
On the contrary, I would say the concept of afterlife gives a sense of peace that it is not over, it's in continuum. in the clinical space for the patients. Conceptually, I would say it works at the back of our minds. Culturally, it stays. So death doesn't come as that kind of a shock. But if you ask me individually for me, yes, because I wish often when I was in the hospital bed, I so wished that I could be religious, that I could believe in afterlife, and that would be so much more giving me inner strength and resilience to deal with this sudden confrontation with mortality.
Yes, I can imagine. You have a patient that you had said demonstrates some of the challenges both you and she faced before and after your illness. And it's a disguised patient. Can you share it with us?
Yes, of course it is a disguised version. And I will share with you the most relevant aspect that is necessary without disclosing anything whatsoever. So during my treatment over the year, even when I was in the hospital and when I came back home, she has sent me very caring messages on and off. Initially, my partner was responding, and then I was directly responding. And she was very open, very concerned. And then when we started work, she came back. And over time, she finally expressed that she thought I was lying to her about my illness when she said, "You look so healthy, so good." So I was happy to hear that internally. So you lied.
Sure.
So she said, "You lied to me. You deprived me. There was something for which you did this to me. There must have been something for which." Yeah. And we started working on this, and which led us to something very, very deep and significant, and where that lying was coming from. And it took us to where her disbelief came from, this aspect of disbelief. And she talked about how she had experienced and in her childhood sexual molestation by one of the senior male members in her family, and she had spoken about it to her mother, and her mother did not believe her about this. But it was not just that. Over time, what happened was that she too started doubting her own self. She couldn't believe whether this actually happened to her or not. And there was, I think, the crux of the disbelief that came from. It was definitely very deep content for both of us to deal with. And as you can see, it was no more about what I went through or the cancer or her disbelief, but it was to do with what she was living with for all these years. And I feel fortunate that I found that opportunity to be able to work with her post my illness and to arrive there, because otherwise, and this takes us back to our earlier the earlier part of our conversation, where the information of my illness may have created more disruption, anxiety, conflict within the patient. So here was an opportunity to look into it at a much deeper level.
You know, I have to share with you my reaction to that clinical vignette. It's really magnificent to me in a particular way. Both as tribute to you and to our method, that no matter what the actual literal reality is that is introduced into the dyad, into the clinical experience, while acknowledging that, It's also an opportunity for us to continue our devotion to understand the patient so they can understand the patient, so that she could learn about her history of dealing with lies and how that has so warped her life. And from that, from her imaginary view of you, she can learn about an authentic sense of herself. And that's such a gift that you were able to give that patient. And it's a testimony that isn't something one can do early on in one's career, I don't believe. I think it takes seasoning to do that, to hold the reality of the present and also invite the patient to be interested into their personal history and personal meaning. And I always find it moving when I hear such appreciation of the human experience, such as you described. So thank you for sharing that.
So true. I'm grateful, actually, that we found the opportunity to be able to work together again. Otherwise, it would have been not possible to reach this very deeper aspect in her. So it's actually, as it's very obvious, it's a joint journey. She gave me that opportunity. She came back and she held on even when the disruption happened. And I'm not sure whether, you know, I did the right thing or the wrong thing, but I did what held to be the most ethical thing to do at that point and let my patient know the cause of the disruption.
Well, I think the outcome you describe, whatever right or wrong means in terms of the thing you did or didn't do, the truth of the matter is that she is a fuller human being having been a patient of yours than had she not. So that from clinical outcome for me is the determiner of what's the right thing. And this clearly was of great benefit for her, which is what we're there to do. You have told me that you have reflected on transience since this ordeal of yours. Transience, as we know, is something that Freud had some profound reflections on. Can you share something with us about how that has grown in you, that sense of transience about life?
Transience? Is that what you...
Yes. Yes.
Yes. I think this has a little to do with the Eastern way of thinking, if I may say so, our cultural upbringing, where the quality of submission to larger aspects in life, which is much larger than life, could be a concept, could be religion, could be God, often which gets equated to our parents, elderly people. The quality of submission gives us the opportunity to learn from situations. And in the process of learning from situations, it takes us to the aspect of having inner resilience to wade through that. And to be able to wade through that with resilience will take us to the aspect of transience, where one on one hand can let it go, while on the other hand, simultaneously, is moving ahead. So emotionally, one is moving forward with the quality of transience, while physically there is a transition, a transformation that maybe I have undergone. And I think the aspect, the notion of transience, where you see even life as something that floats by, and it helps one to be able to look at life, which is not stagnant. It floats. It passes by. And I think that has helped me to be able to deal with mortality, to still deal with it. I find the quality of transience in Japanese treatment, in their culture, in psychoanalysis, very, very poignant.
You also have had thoughts about analysis, as you said earlier, off the couch, how your experience has broadened your sense of how we analysts can bring a useful way of thinking to the community at large. Can you share that with our listeners?
I'm actually reminded of another case of mine who was with me for about 2 years. She was having difficulty with pregnancy and was trying the IVF process, which was not working favorably for her. And after our work over the 2 years, she successfully conceived. And at that point, she discontinued with therapy. She did not have the need to. She felt she was happy and she was ready to deliver and she was ready for a fresh life with her child and family. The reason I'm reminded of her, and I had mentioned this to you probably before, is because she came back to invite me actually for her son's first rice eating ceremony. So this is very special in our culture when yes. the child mm-hmm. would be taking rice for the first time. I think that's at about a few months, 6 months time or something like that. And at that time, I didn't know how to respond to it. And I had told her that in the kind of work that we do, that it's not possible, unfortunately, for me to accept her invitation and go for the occasion. And she was actually very, very upset. And she taught me so much from that. She told me that if I don't accept the invitation and come, especially since we have worked on this together, and I know this very deep and painful aspect that she had gone through for so long, that it would be a bad omen for her son. And that was not desirable, of course. And that kind of woke me up and told me probably that I have to go beyond the books, the analytic books. And I did say that I'm sorry and I understand her perspective and I was happy to go. I said I will be absolutely delighted and honored to go and see her son and bless her son. So, but I may not be able to join for the meal. And that for me is an extension of on the couch to off the couch, and which I think increasingly now is very, very important in our analytic work, in our therapeutic, or I would say in our clinical work, because the clinical space or the capacity, the way I have experienced, it may be limited, but I do find it very limited. There's so much that we have to extend to. So we'll have to find ways of extending our clinical understanding and work into the community, and for which maybe the old rule books need redefinition and reworking. It feels uncertain, and I'm not sure, and I wish I could talk more with my colleagues about such things so that one feels more confident about, you know, taking upon such measures. But thank you for talking to me about this.
You know, you've said so much, we could spend so much more time on it. The notion of wishing to be confident before we took such measures, Freud certainly was not confident, truly, when he made his discoveries and went verbally to places that no one had gone to before in clinical work. And I don't think we can maintain the bar of, well, we'll only do it when we're confident. I think we need to tolerate uncertainty. And with that comes risk, of course. With your patient, the story of if you don't go, it would be a bad omen for her child. I mean, we could spend a great deal of time talking about that. And considering for patients for whom it being a bad omen is a fact, not a fantasy, but is a fact, and you have to work around that as their fact, which is a different category of someone, maybe more so in the West, but not necessarily, actually. Then you have to make a clinical choice, and I think your choice was inordinately sensible. And I wish I could have a podcast around the topic of analysts who have been to ceremonies in their patients' lives, because it is not so infrequent. It is something that people often don't speak of because it is said to be off the books. And yet it is a vast source of understanding of the nature of our work and the nature of the mind, both the patient's and ours.
I just wanted to add to what you said, so very important. I think the clarity of the intent of the ethical benevolence of the patient, I think that is most significant to have in mind.
I began our conversation with expressing appreciation to you for your sharing your medical journey and your wisdom that has emerged from it. I'm thinking of that patient who came to you paranoid and thinking that you had lied to her, and you gave her a gift of self-awareness. You've given us a gift, me certainly personally, but I think our listeners have received a great deal from you, because there are areas of our work that are filled with uncertainty. And whatever little pieces of guidance we can get from those who have traveled before us, we collect them dearly and learn from them and share them and teach them. And you clearly are one of those people who we will collect your wisdom and learn from it and share it. And we will all benefit from it, not just your patients. So I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you so much, Harvey. It's been a delight and my honor to be here with you in the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.